This is KOOP HD1 HD3 Hornsby. Welcome to Civil Rights and Wrongs, the state of your civil liberties in the Lone Star State. The views expressed here are not necessarily those of the co-op board of directors, staff, volunteers, or underwriters. The following program was homecrafted and recorded on March 11th. Thanks for the handoff, Rocky, and thanks to everyone who recently donated to Co-op's Spring Membership Drive. We couldn't do this without your support. Last September, the Pew Charitable Trusts issued a report titled, "Disinformation May Be the New Normal, Election Officials Fear." Nonpartisan voting officials ask themselves how they can counter false narratives. One election administrator contends that many misunderstandings about the election system can be resolved by showing voters how tabulation works and the security measures that are in place. Nevertheless, despite efforts to inform voters through community events and online campaigns, there is a sizable portion of the electorate that will not listen to election officials, according to Kat Calvin, founder of a voting rights group called Spread the Vote. Worse, it can be an enormous challenge when candidates are deliberately lying. Calvin recommends that these candidates be held accountable by having their lies called out. However, she believes that the root cause goes deeper than voter fraud or what a candidate is saying. We're seeing the effects of years and years of people living in different silos, different worlds, with different facts. It's beyond what your Board of Elections can do. Jim Irizarry, a California Assistant Registrar of Voters, thinks that fighting misconceptions takes an arsenal: culture, technology, laws, and transparency. Officials must use verifiable means to demonstrate that the system is accurate, not fraudulent. You kind of pick the argument apart. For the most part, people do listen, but it's a lot of work. It's not wine and roses. Good evening and welcome to Civil Rights and Wrongs on Co-op 91.7 in Austin, streaming through koop.org. I'm your host, Bob Daly. Our guest this evening is Brandon Rottinghouse, professor of political science at the University of Houston. 2 weeks ago, he and colleague Jeronimo Cortina co-authored an article in the Washington Post titled, "With the 2022 Midterms Ahead, Expect Another Latino Misinformation Crisis." We're also joined by Jim Harrington, retired founder of the Texas Civil Rights Project. Brandon, so glad to have you here with us today. Thanks for joining us.
Yeah, happy to do it. Thank you for having me.
Could you tell us a little about yourself first, personally, and your own academic research interests?
Sure. I grew up in Plano, Texas, just outside of Dallas, and spent basically my whole life there. And I ended up going to Purdue University in Indiana, and then from there went to Northwestern for my PhD. So a couple of kind of cold weather states for several years. Definitely, it was a shock to this Texan to have to go buy like a really bulky winter coat and sweaters and fleece, everything. So it was a great experience, though, and I got interested there in kind of racial politics. And so my PhD studied kind of intersections of behavior and institutions. And so after, you know, doing work in various executive projects, we came back to Texas, came back here to Houston, and have really enjoyed it, and partnered with my colleague Geronimo on a couple of these papers. We've looked at issues involving the location of vote centers vis-a-vis the kind of racial clustering in particular counties. And so we got interested in other questions because we were hearing these persistent rumors and even some cases actual evidence of the misinformation that was happening in and around the Latino community. This peaked in the 2020 election cycle, where there were several stories about this, and we were seeing and hearing about lots of these different things that were happening. So we started to get curious. So we had actually been doing a series of polls with Univision, where we partnered with them to do kind of a Texas portion of a longer poll that they were doing in the Southwest. So we were able to add questions in 2020 that, on our hunch, you know, potentially explored and tracked how misinformation was occurring at the local level in Texas. And lo and behold, we found a whole lot of things going on. A lot of it was pretty shocking.
Yeah, I imagine so. Just to start off, to kind of level set here a little bit, some authors kind of distinguish between disinformation and misinformation. Do you make such a distinction? And could you just define what you mean by misinformation?
Yeah, it's a really good question, because the literature in political science separates the two of these, in part because the mechanisms that create them are different. We actually are thinking broadly about misinformation and conspiracy theories. In particular, in this paper and in the article that we wrote that kind of summarized the paper, we look at conspiracy theories. And so conspiracy theories are typically related to perceptions that people are out to get you. I think that's the kind of core of it. As I explained to people, there are all kinds of psychological reasons why this is true. But in effect, the core of it is that people are worried that there's some kind of big brother element out there that's watching. And we look at conspiracy theories in particular related to three different components. And so we look at the question about whether or not people believe that the coronavirus was intentionally planted by powerful people. We ask whether or not Joe Biden would be under the influence of the Black Lives Matter or Antifa movements. And then finally, we ask people if they believe that there's a deep state that's out to get Donald Trump. We found between a third and in some cases almost up to half of Latino respondents in Texas in our poll believe that these things were true. So that's a lot, way more than we thought it would be. So this is really a set of kind of conspiracy beliefs. And it's one part of misinformation, which, as you say, is different in some ways. Misinformation is more about trying to mislead people and to, you know, provide false information that they might accept. The literature on this is pretty clear. It suggests that people, once they believe something, are likely to keep believing it. And even in experimental work where people are given correctives that show it's not true, the things you just heard, they still are likely to believe it. And usually it's related to this kind of partisan hardening. So they're different concepts. We're exploring them somewhat together, and in work that's ongoing with a survey that we're going to field in the fall, we're expanding this and effectively doing something very similar to see if there are any kind of correctives that might work to prevent this from happening.
And this research was primarily conducted in September 2020, is that correct, prior to the election?
That's right. There was a series of polls that we worked with Univision to complete. And so this was in one of the waves of those polls.
Yeah, the figures you cite are surprising and really disappointing, I guess. Do you have any sense about where all this came from? I mean, was somebody intentionally planting these ideas, or did they just kind of catch on organically? Or what was the genesis of all this?
Yeah, a little of both. We definitely see this being created organically. People have big microphones and sometimes they misuse them. That's certainly the case. We're seeing a lot of evidence of this happening, and there's a lot of secondary discussion about this in the media. It's also in some ways the case that this is being planted for purposes of trying to dissuade people from voting. It's harder to prove that, but Washington Post is doing a longer expose of how these things are happening. And so they're finding some interesting things with respect to the ways that these sorts of patterns are forming. there's all kinds of unusual things out there. And people will believe a lot of things that you think that they wouldn't. For instance, we found evidence that there's a one local radio show host who claimed that the founder of Black Lives Matter had practiced witchcraft. There's another that suggested that there was a brooch that was worn by Lady Gaga at some high profile red carpet event that signaled that Joe Biden was working with shadowy leftist figures. So there's a lot of this that's happening. And what's really causing it is interesting. And so one of the things we find is that this is really triggering a couple of things. It's first triggering a sense of kind of racial difference, in some cases, a kind of racial competition. And the other thing it's doing is it's priming a sense of dissatisfaction or maybe dislike of socialism. And so a lot of people have, you know, come from countries, their families have come from countries where, you know, socialist governments are in effect. And that's something that's frightening for a lot of people. Another mechanism here, and we find this in the paper, is that there's a strong Trump effect where people who are supporters of Donald Trump are more likely to endorse or to express a belief in these conspiracy theories. It didn't hold for all Republicans. So it wasn't just a Republican phenomenon. It was definitely a Trump-based Republican phenomenon. So there are a lot of ways that that's solved now, but in some ways the problem is kind of expanded from that.
So Jim, you're working in a Latino environment. Jim was founder of the Texas Civil Rights Project, now retired and working in a largely Latino Episcopalian parish in East Austin. What's been your experience along these lines, Jim?
Well, I haven't seen this sort of phenomenon in the people that I'm with, but I do know, and this is sort of alarming, that they are seeing this stuff because even though they will discount it, they do raise it to talk about. So obviously it's alive. And it may also mean they're hearing this stuff from coworkers and family members and friends. Yeah. So I was curious, and you may have touched on this in your last comments, why you think that people are picking this up or why they have this tendency to believe the misinformation.
Yeah, it's a good question, Jim. We theoretically connect this to bigger questions and concerns about how people relate to the political world. For instance, we know that conspiracy theories are more likely to catch on to people who have lower levels of political efficacy. That is, they don't feel like their vote matters, their participation matters. So they're more likely to believe that there are these kind of global forces working against them. We also know that people who feel like the system is rigged against them are also more likely to believe these conspiracy theories. And there's a lot of evidence that suggests that Latinos in particular believe that this is occurring for them. So those are a couple of big reasons. Another is, like we said, there's certainly evidence that in a times of economic crisis, there's a kind of racial competition. And in fact, there's an article today in Axios about the ways in which there's been a kind of rise of white fascist Latino leaders, which is unusual, I think, as it sounds. But this is, I think, caused by this kind of economic downturn, compression of wages, and people's feeling like they're not getting anywhere despite working hard. So a lot of that sort of discrimination queuing is happening in these conspiracy theory questions. So for instance, especially on like the Black Lives Matter question, a lot of people believe that because there is this kind of racial threat issue that's come up. So those are a few reasons why people believe it. Typically, those are the kind of biggest factors that cause it. Then there are idiosyncratic reasons why people believe it. I mean, exposure is one thing. And a non-corrected belief in these things is another. So for instance, you know, social media platforms leaving up this information, you know, doesn't help. It certainly allows for more people to be exposed to it. And as a result, sometimes it gets shared and reshared, and then it becomes more fact than fiction.
And how would you think, what would be an effective corrective action, if there is any? I'm sort of pessimistic that there is any, but I'd like to see if you have any thoughts on that.
Yeah, we do. And we're, you know, trying to kind of identify some solutions because we hate to just identify a problem without the corollary of a solution. I mean, one thing that can be done is that certainly we see an increase in belief among conspiracy theories among people who are using Spanish language media outlets. And so it's certainly the case, and to some degree they have, these Spanish language media outlets can do some corrective work to sort of highlight these things that aren't true and then to tell people that that's what's going on. So some of that corrective can happen at the mass level. The other is that social media companies can make sure to take down some of the things that are still up. So for instance, reports from various groups like Equus out there who study this show that more than 70% of Spanish language misinformation has stayed online, and that's compared to about 29% of English language misinformation. So just it being there is one thing that's continuing to perpetuate that problem. So removing that might help. The other is something that some companies are doing. You know, Facebook has announced that they're hiring a lot more Spanish language, you know, checkers. And so there are more people out there who are conversant in the language who can make determinations about whether or not something is factual or not, or, you know, increase the need to put some kind of disclaimer on it. So there are some things that can be done, some fairly simple things that in English have been done, but that haven't been done in the Spanish language side of things.
Do you have any sense about why that's the case?
Yeah, it's a good question. I mean, I think partly it was just, it happened so fast. And so no one's really prepared for it. And the other is that these things change so rapidly. The kind of source of these things and how people are sharing things is like a wildfire, especially in social media. And that's one of the biggest triggers of people's belief in this. So there are, of course, you know, these moments that complicate things. And so I don't want to suggest that these companies and organizations are to blame for this, but they're certainly not checking as carefully as they could.
Interesting. You know, I've just got a ton of questions here. Pardon me if I'm bouncing around here a little bit.
But,
you know, so you partnered with Univision, which has a pretty wide audience. You know, when you're talking about Spanish-speaking America here, you know, I think about dealing with Mexican-Americans in Texas and dealing with Cuban-Americans in Miami. I mean, surely we're not talking about a monolithic community here, are we?
No, without question, we're not. In Texas, though, or at least in our survey, most of the sort of nativity of peoples or their families were from Mexico. So it does tend to be more heavily sort of Central American and North American. And that's slightly different from, as you say, Florida, where there are more people from Cuba. So we do expect to see these differences. In our data, we didn't have enough to be able to make those distinctions. So we're hopeful to be able to get a bigger sample for our next round of analysis. But as it is now, we weren't able to dig down that deep. But a lot of the anecdotal evidence suggests, I think, what you're hinting at, and that is that Cuban Americans are very susceptible to this. They tend to be more conservative anyway, so they're more likely to believe it. And that in some ways makes it more scary, because people who aren't necessarily inclined to believe it and who have voted for a more, you know, liberal ticket, typically Democrats, are believing it more.
I mean, throwing around the S word, you know, socialism, to scare people, that's got to be worse in the Caribbean areas than here, I would think.
Yeah, I think it is. Yeah. And we have an imperfect picture of how people process this information. So we're trying to kind of narrow it down and make it more clear. But it's clearly the case that there are sort of families and communities who are worried about these sorts of issues. And even if they don't come from a country that had a primarily socialist kind of government, it is the case that they understand what that might mean for them. And even if they don't understand, they're worried about it. And maybe that's even worse. So definitely these things are occurring. And a lot of this is triggering that. I'll say too, that one of the things that we're looking at in addition to the Latino community is to look at the Asian community. This is another of the fastest growing of the demographics in Texas and in the country. And so although they typically vote for Democrats, there's a sizable portion who are supporting Republicans. And so there's definitely some party divide there in the similar growing way that we see in the Latino community. So we're going to field a survey that'll look at that as well to see if, again, the same kind of things are triggering this misinformation in the Asian community.
You know, of the different categories of misinformation that you cite in the Post article, the one that really scared me was racial resentment, pitting Blacks against Latinos. What are your thoughts about this? I mean, how prevalent is this? And talk about poisoning the well.
Yeah, there's a lot of evidence and scholarship on the question about how people of different races politically align and how they grow to be able to work together in various communities. And I think that the thrust of it suggests that it can be done. The coalitions can be formed and political success can be had. But like you say, this can be undone very easily. And I think, and I don't have a way to prove this, and I have to kind of look closely to see whether it's accurate or not, but I think that the kind of economic downturn creates these problems where there is this friction, and that friction can lead to these kinds of moments where people are susceptible to believe this. It's worth noting too that, as you say, you know, there's not a kind of homogeneity of the Latino community. And so age matters in this too. The younger generation tends to be slightly more progressive than the older generation. So we certainly find that effect a little bit more pronounced there. But we definitely see that happening. And it's worrisome to find out how little it takes to kind of probe and to prime that racial resentment.
I have to say that this is one of the things that when I was working in the Valley that struck me was the racism that existed in the Mexican American community toward the Black community.
Yeah.
Because you would think everybody ought to be aligned here. But, you know, if you look at our history and if you look at our economic system, the divide and conquer has always been upmost. We saw, you know, how racism and Jim Crow developed in the South, dividing the poor whites and the Blacks, even though they would have had the same economic interests. It just seems to me it points to how sophisticated our system is in a bad way, that it can keep this polarization going. And of course, that polarization deflects from any substantial social change.
Yeah, I think you're right. And it is shocking to see, and everybody who's been in and around the Valley or who has friends who are from there has seen this. It's anecdotal in lots of ways, but it definitely exists. And so, yeah, we're trying to track the kind of process through which people are understanding this, because there's a lot of things that are at play. And this really is just one thing that's sort of promoting it and exacerbating some of these divisions, but it's not going to go away. And so I think a lot of people thought that, you know, once you kind of have President Trump move on to being ex-President Trump, that we won't have the same kind of problems as we did. But things are continuing, and in some ways they're getting worse. Like I said, this Axios article has got this interesting story about the rise of kind of white nationalism inside the Latino community. We've also got this new conservative Latino media network, which is coming out. And so there are fears that these sorts of highly organized creations may exacerbate some of the problems that we've found.
In my view, too, the political disenfranchisement has occurred, at least here in Texas, because of the Democratic Party's inattention to Hispanic community, taking it for granted and not doing that organizing at ground level that has to be done. You know, and that alienation, I think, opens up the possibility, as you're articulating, of people moving in and playing off of that sense of alienation. If you look at our primaries, for example, you know, that are heavily, heavily white. And it's just like there's no effort by the party to create the diversity that you're going to need at ground level. And there's just no organizing. I mean, to me, part of Trump's success, or the extent that it was success in the Valley, is, again, the fault of the party to effectively be community organizers. And maybe that's the problem. And maybe the party is just, you know, so antiquated and unattuned to what's going on. I don't know, yeah. But you certainly can see why that success is happening.
I think it's a great point. I should have mentioned that between graduate school and college, I worked in campaigns and actually during college worked on a campaign here in Texas. The first Latino Senate candidate from Texas, Victor Morales, ran in 1996 and beat two established members of Congress to get the nomination, and eventually went on to lose to Phil Graham. And I worked on a campaign. And so seeing how the organization was lacking in several places where, as a Latino candidate, you needed to be really strong was definitely worrisome. And you also sort of, I think you're right, see the party neglecting this over the years. In some polling that we did related to this, that was the October version of those polls, we found that significant percentages of Latinos were not that concerned about a kind of value match or that a candidate matched to policy positions. They cared mostly about whether or not the candidates were listening to them and respecting their views. In fact, we found 41% of Latinos claim that they would prefer a candidate who listened and respected their views. And that's the most important factor in their vote. The next most important was shared values at 27%. So there are just a lot of people out there who want to be heard. And Republicans have responded and have built these kind of listening centers. They've developed these community areas where they can do these little workshops and, you know, kind of community building activities. And it's not necessarily about the Republican Party, but it certainly gels with it because that's partly the values they're instilling in, you know, people who are there. And of course, all the paraphernalia is there for that too. So Republicans have responded in a way that the Democrats have not. And it's not just about showing up once every 2 years. It's really continuous. And the faster that both parties realize this, the better they're going to do in these neighborhoods.
You know, in your article, you cite some statistics about the Latino population and elections that were somewhat striking to me. We know that especially in states like Texas, Arizona, California, Florida, the Latino population is really significant. But even nationwide, we're talking about numbers that, you know, are approaching not even a minority anymore, right?
Yeah, that's right. Some of the data are pretty stunning to see. Yeah. So like you said, we note that Latinos make up about 44% of the voting age population and about 60% of the voting age population at the national level. So yeah. This is a clear indication that the future of Texas is Latino. And the parties clearly recognize this in different degrees. And mm-hmm. So they need to be able to focus on these kinds of issues. Almost half of the voting population will be Latino in Texas. And so a lot of them are young, really young. And so that's really where the future is. The sooner parties recognize that, the more likely they're going to be successful. And that's what makes these kinds of findings so concerning, where, as I said, you literally have a third to almost half of Latinos saying that they believe these, you know, wacky conspiracy theories. It's frustrating to see, and it's clearly related to some kind of factors that need to be corrected.
And so the Post article was kind of an abbreviated version of a longer article you mentioned. Has that article been published already?
Yeah, it's been accepted. And so it'll be out shortly. They have to kind of process it and do all the checking of the data and make sure they correct our all of our syntax errors and whatnot. Right. But it has been accepted. And academic publishing is odd because the time between when it's officially accepted and when you can actually look at it can sometimes be years. In this case, this journal is really fast, but we should see it pretty soon.
And what publication will that be in?
It's a journal called Research in Politics.
Well, we'll be watching for that for sure.
We need to take a short station break, but we'll be right back. Stay tuned. Welcome back to Civil Rights and Wrongs on Co-op 91.7 in Austin, streaming through koop.org. I'm your host, Bob Daly. This evening's show was homecrafted and recorded on March 11th. Our guest is Brandon Rottinghouse, professor of political science at the University of Houston. Let's pick up where we left off.
There's a macho element going on here, particularly in the Trump supporters in the Valley. And I'm curious about what that is, if that's reflecting something beyond what you're describing as this racial polarization that has existed, but it's now manifesting itself these ways.
Yeah, it's a really good question. We thought we would find an effect by gender because we suspected, like you do, that there's a kind of machismo effect. In fact, some of the literature suggests this is true. And then certain media reports claim that you would find this division, especially with respect to the support for Trump. But we actually didn't find it. And so that was, I think, kind of unusual. So at least in terms of believing these three conspiracies, that didn't have any strong effect. But I do think that there's a Trump effect at work there for that. And partly it's related to economics too. Those are all connected to the similar kind of profile of a person who would support Donald Trump. So for instance, lack of trust in local news or national news, having, you know, higher trust in kind of social media. And so these are things that are a kind of subset of a profile of people who generally support Donald Trump. So the fact that they're Latino certainly played into that, but it was not something we found as like a specific, separate, statistically significant variable. But we're going to keep looking because there's certainly some kind of effect here in terms of support, in terms of support for Trump.
You know, and the other thing that I think is related, where I also saw this manifest, is this reaction against the vaccine. The same sort of bravado, you know, in the terms of the Trump support, manifested itself adamantly opposed to the vaccine.
Yeah, it's a really good point. We were finding a lot of that. Yeah. And so some of the misinformation that's been out there is about the COVID vaccine. I haven't seen a lot of academic work on that, but that's definitely coming because we've seen calls for grants to study this. So I'm certain we're going to find more about this as we go along. I guess I'll say this. We know it's happening. We don't know why it's happening. And so part of what we're trying to do with this is to get a little bit closer to describe the kind of covariates that predict when a person might not believe science or might believe these sort of conspiracy theories. And then from there, we can develop kind of broader theories about, you know, who might and might not believe them. So I think you're right. And believing conspiracy theories about politicians is one thing, but believing how, you know, the coronavirus is planted by powerful people, or the vaccines don't work or cause other kinds of issues, are definitely worse in a way because it's going to affect people's behavior that could hurt them and their families. So that's something that definitely needs to be corrected.
Early on in the pandemic here, one of our guests was Paul Saldana. He's probably one of the top Latino leaders in Austin. You know, to listen to him and the way that the city of Austin bungled its response to pandemic, especially in the Latino community, you could almost understand why this sense of a conspiracy, you know, with respect to the coronavirus could take hold. I'm retired myself. I tutor at Navarro High School here, which is 90% Latino and about 6% Black. And, you know, I talk to these kids. You find out that this one's uncle died of the coronavirus and that one's mother was hospitalized. And it's a very different story from the white circles that I usually find myself in.
Yeah, it's sad to see, and it's preventable in all kinds of ways. But I think that this all happened so quickly that there weren't really responses in place. And the fact that it wasn't caught is certainly a reflection of the fact that people weren't really thinking about this from the start. And not surprisingly, then you find the results that you do. So I guess the only good news in all this is that people are now beginning to recognize how complicated these communications are and how delicately they should be handled. They're also, I think, are recognizing that being more precise about how you talk about these sorts of things is really important, and making sure it's communicated across different levels. I have a podcast here with Houston Public Media, and actually Geronimo and I do the podcast together. And so one of the things that we did at the end of the year was to bring in scholars, talk about some of the big trends that they see. And one of the things you don't see very often in, as one of the guests commented, in Texas, is just a kind of translation of materials into Spanish and other languages too that people speak. We speak dozens of languages in the state. So obviously that's another sort of complication to this. But to me, it's all fixable. To me, once we have some good information, we can kind of drill into how these things are coming about and understand a little bit more about the kind of elements that make it up. It's something that can be addressed and maybe not fixed forever, because there'll always be some people who believe these things no matter what, and they're going to be exposed to incorrect information and it'll never be corrected. And even if it was, they wouldn't believe it. So that's always going to happen, but we can certainly address the problems that we've got and hopefully make this a little bit less impactful.
You and Geronimo do public radio programs, right, in Houston?
Yeah, we do. I keep calling it a podcast, but we started as a podcast and then they put it on the radio. So it actually airs on Friday nights at 10 o'clock, the coveted Friday 10 o'clock spot. and so, but we also put it in a podcast too. So you can catch it on podcast form.
Yeah, I've heard you guys when I've been in Houston. It's really good.
Thank you. Yeah, we like to have fun. Sometimes it's a little hard when, for instance, you've got a tough week of atrocities on the ground in Ukraine and just, you know, bare knuckle politics here in Texas. But we try to break it down and give people a kind of sense of what's really happening and summarize it as best we can and bring not an academic perspective, but certainly bring some context to what's going on.
Well, we're running out of time. I want to get you to your next appointment, but could you just tell us a little about ongoing research, where you're headed from here?
Yeah. So like I said, we're going to field a series of surveys, hopefully before the November election and then after the November election, where we investigate these questions further. This was really a first step towards trying to explain this. We only use three questions in terms of conspiracy. So we'd like to expand that a little bit more. And so, like I said, we're going to look at the Latino community and also the Asian community to see if similar kinds of patterns are at work, because we've seen anecdotal evidence that it's affecting both communities. And like we know from the Latino community, the Asian community is growing in terms of its importance in politics in Texas. The other thing we're going to do with this research is to see how correctives work. One of the things that we can do is to make predictions about who's likely to believe these sorts of things. The other is to see how corrections might function. So we're going to try to do some experimental design within that survey to see if people believe a certain conspiracy, what does it take to convince them that it's not true? How much convincing do they need? And how long does it last? And so it's an uphill battle. You're always fighting against misinformation or these kind of conspiracies that people see. We, I think, as a country have become, you know, kind of too strongly connected to the ease of information, right? People don't want to read deeply anymore. You don't want to really think about what this all means. It's like somebody tells you something and you just kind of repeat it. It speaks to the persuasion that these social media, especially sites, have on us. And so working with that and around that is going to be the kind of next great crisis that the nation faces in terms of misinformation. So we're hoping to see what affects that. We're hoping to see what can correct it and then how long that correction can occur.
Keep up the good work. It's really interesting. And it's, you know, it's just really puzzling. But, you know, I was reflecting last night. I mentioned, you know, how people in Russia can believe Russian propaganda. And somebody reminded me, well, 40% of Americans believe this right-wing propaganda. So it's kind of disconcerting when you believe that facts exist and that they should be persuasive.
That's a great point. And the scholarship shows once people believe something, it's really hard to get them to not believe it. And they believe things that are consistent with their predetermined political beliefs. So the reason some of these conspiracy theories and this misinformation is so potent is that they're already inclined to believe it. Some of these factors are psychological and they're just sort of as the people are, like that's how you're wired. And some of them are, you know, kind of political in origin. So it depends on the person, but it's definitely the case that it's challenging to convince people that these things aren't true. And so our hope is to see what that might look like and if we can make a difference in doing so.
We really appreciate your time here today. This was most informative. Learned quite a bit from this conversation. So thanks for making time for us, and we wish you the very best with your continued research there.
Absolutely. I appreciate it. And thanks for giving us a chance to talk about the research and have this conversation.
It's Thursday afternoon, March 10th. And once again, we're speaking with Austin Sanders, staff writer for the Austin Chronicle. Good afternoon, Austin. How's life?
I'm doing all right. Thanks for having me on.
Well, great. We missed you last week, but glad to have you back. Brent Bingaman brought us up to date on what was going on with the latest BLM protest settlement with Brad Levi Ayala.
Glad that he was able to come on. Brent is certainly one of the leading experts in our community on the survivors of that weekend of protests. So he's the best person you could have talked to get updates on those settlements and what it's been like for the survivors. So I'm glad that he was able to come on.
It was great to have him. And it's great to have you back. There's no city council meeting today, which is why we're doing this on Thursday today. But last Thursday, there was a council meeting and a couple of interesting things. Maybe for me, the most interesting thing on the agenda last week was 6th Street. What was council talking about there?
Yeah, you know, council isn't meeting this week or next week because of South by Southwest. They kind of take off those weeks, not require staff or council members to drive downtown during that time because it's going to be kind of crazy. And that's important because this resolution from downtown council member, District 9 council member, and mayoral candidate, Kathy Tovo, is kind of top of mind for a lot of people because its goal is to kind of further instruct staff in ways to make 6th Street safer. This is a initiative council took up last year. I'm sure your listeners will recall the mass shooting that occurred on 6th Street late at night that left 14 people injured and one man was killed by teenagers coming to Austin from Killeen. This kind of, I guess I should say, renewed interest on council and at City Hall to explore ways to make 6th Street, the district, which is a really big tourist attraction, kind of our Bourbon Street that has a lot of nightlife activity, make it a safer space through a variety of ways, which the resolution is really wide ranging and asks staff to look at a lot of different things. One thing that stood out to me was this idea of what the resolution calls small scale activations in the right of way. So these are kind of just would be like little pop-up shops, whether they're restaurants or little shops that may be in the right of way to kind of introduce different uses into the district beyond what is really dominated by clubs and bars in that area. It's going to ask staff to survey business owners in the area to determine what kind of uses they think would fit best, what kind of customers they would hope to bring in, even looking at funding grants to businesses who want to open kitchens, add kitchens to their bars perhaps or other buildings they own to kind of increase the restaurant space to kind of balance out the bar space that kind of dominates the 6th Street district. This resolution is continuing work that the council has already started, restarted, I should say, looking for ways to make 6th Street a safer place with more diverse uses. You know, one of the other things staff is kind of asked to study what's going on during the festival season, which we're in the middle of, or at the beginning of, I should say, with South By, and then kind of incorporate what they find there into their recommendations for things they could do to kind of, again, improve the safety of that area.
So that it doesn't feel like just one big bar, huh?
Yeah, exactly. Right. Yeah. If your listeners have been down to 6th Street at midnight or later on the parts that are blocked off, you know, it's people walking in and out of bars in the right of way in the street, which again is blocked off to vehicular traffic. So it's not dangerous or anything. But there's been enough violent episodes in recent years to have kind of, again, renewed interest in this goal for council.
I don't suppose anybody's suggesting that we make it a little harder for people to get guns in the state of Texas, huh?
Yeah, exactly. Right. Yeah, that's another goal. Yeah, right.
Right. Well, we wish them well. So it sounds like there's a study phase to this thing, right?
Yeah. Staff, again, has been kind of looking at this for a little while, but they'll kind of report back later this year with some of their suggestions on what the city can do to make it safer.
We may be hearing more about that as time passes. Well, speaking of city council, Bill Aylshire just initiated a lawsuit against the city dealing with district boundaries. Geez, I thought we had that all resolved. What's going on there?
Yeah, not to Mr. Aylshire's satisfaction. This is the former Travis County judge who is in, you know, private practice now, and is kind of an activist attorney around City Hall. He's launched several lawsuits against the city of Austin. Previous ones have been over language approved by the city council on ballot initiatives, on some of these petition initiatives that we voted on in the city in the past few years. He's initiated lawsuits over the language that council has approved. This is a little different. It's an interesting argument. Basically, following the 10-year census, the census that occurs every 10 years, just like state lawmakers redraw congressional maps for the state house and the U.S. Congress, There are local volunteers that are part of a group that's called the Independent Citizens Redistricting Commission that redraw the city council and Travis County Commissioner Court's boundaries. And this process has resulted in some, 40, 50,000 voters being moved from one district to another as those district lines have moved. And according to Aylshire's analysis and the lawsuit he filed, somewhere close to 26,000 voters have been, as he calls it, disenfranchised temporarily by this process. And what he means by that is you have voters who were moved from a district, a council district that would be on the November 8th ballot this year. That would be council districts 1, 3, 5, 8, and 9. So voters were moved from one of those districts to one of the five districts that are not going to be on the ballot. So that's 2, 4, 6, 7, and 10. Those seats were just reelected in 2020. And so you have this situation where for some of these voters, what Aylshire calls disadvantaged voters, and there's about 7,000 of them, so it's not an insignificant number, all from districts 1, 5, and 9, they basically won't be able to vote for who elects them on the city council for a total of 6 years, because the last election they would have voted in was the 2018 council elections when districts 1, 3, 5, and 9 were all on the ballot. So we have this interesting situation where voters, by the decision making of this redistricting commission, will be denied the chance to vote for at least until 2024. When the other round of council offices are on the ballot. And so basically what Aylshire is asking the court to order is that council require all 10 council offices to be on the ballot in November. And this is something that he asked the city clerk about, and the city clerk says that it wouldn't cost the city any additional money to hold these elections. It would just kind of mess with this staggered election format that the 10-1 council adopted when voters approved this change in our government in 2010. And then in 2014, when all the council members were elected for the first time, they basically had a lottery, and some of them would serve 2-year terms and then face re-election. And then, winner of that re-election would be on a 4-year term. And then others just got a 4-year term right off the bat. And this was to allow for these staggered terms. So where you only have 5 council offices on the ballot every 2 years to maintain the staggered thing. Aylshire's request would kind of complicate that. There are ways possibly to preserve the staggered format. Basically, the Texas Senate does this. After redistricting, every member faces re-election. And then they draw lots to determine who gets the short term and who gets the full term to kind of maintain the staggered election format. But yeah, I mean, it's interesting. Council members are not going to want to run for re-election 2 years into their 4-year term, but it'll be interesting to see how they react the closer we get to the candidate filing deadline, which is in late August. And that's the time when council has to order this election. So we'll expect some kind of resolution to this lawsuit by then at the latest, but hopefully sooner, so we can have some clarity on what the courts think needs to happen here.
It seems to me that there was a commitment made to the 5 council members that were just elected a year and a half ago that they would be serving for 4 years, right? And so,
right.
I mean, it just sounds like no matter which way you slice this, somebody's not going to be happy,
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, and I talked to Aylshire about his lawsuit, and he acknowledged that, right? That, in a sense, it's unfair to these council members to say, when you were elected in 2020, you thought you were being elected to a 4-year term, but actually, sorry, it's only a 2-year term, and you've got to run for re-election if you want to hang on to that seat for the rest of the 2 years. But Aylshire would say, as he told me, but what about the voters who are, in effect, disenfranchised for a period, right? Should we be more concerned about elected officials having to campaign again before they wanted to, or more concerned about the voters who are going to have to wait, you know, years in some cases before they can vote for who's representing them on their local government?
Sure, I'm glad I'm not the judge in this case.
Right, yeah, yeah. We'll see. It's kind of an unprecedented case. Obviously, you know, the 10-1 council system was implemented shortly after the 2010 census, or, you know, midway between the 2010 and 2020 census. So there's not really a lot of other, even around the country, a lot of other cities that have dealt with this. So it'll be an interesting ruling to watch out for.
We actually did a couple shows with the ICRC with Christina and Luis, the chair and co-chair respectively. And I know that the whole commission bent over backwards to try to accommodate as many people as they could. And they had probably way too many open meetings or hearings. Toward the end, nobody was attending, which kind of says that they were open to plenty of public input.
Right.
It's not back to the drawing board for them necessarily. They were basically concerning themselves with the maps.
And, yeah, right. Yeah, there's no issue with the maps and Aylshire's lawsuit, the way they were drawing or anything like that. Just this kind of unavoidable fact that people are going to get moved around during redistricting. And sometimes that means you may have been expecting to vote for a council office, but you get moved into a district that's not on the ballot. So it'll be interesting to see the city's position on this lawsuit.
Well, speaking of elections, we had the Travis County Commissioner's District elections 2 weeks ago, and most of those were not very close, except for one of them, right?
Yeah, the Precinct 2 race was not very close. That was between Bridget Shea and Bob Leibel, and Bridget Shea, the incumbent, won re-election handily. But in Precinct 4, which is kind of like the southeastern part of Travis County out near Circuit of the Americas, includes Del Valle, you know, 20-year incumbent Margaret Gomez was challenged by Susanna Ledesma Woody, who's a former Del Valle ISD school board trustee and has become an activist, community volunteer in Del Valle Community Coalition, which is really active during the pandemic, doing a lot of good work. She became really active there and mounted a really significant challenge to Gomez, giving Gomez's stature in Travis County Democratic politics. And it was a close race. After election night, Ledesma Woody was somewhere around 220 votes within victory, about 1% of the total. A pretty high margin to overcome in a recount, but very close. And so her campaign was considering requesting that the Travis County Democratic Party conduct a recount. But after the Travis County clerk canvassed more of the votes and counted more of the outstanding mail ballots, that margin widened to, I think, more than 250 votes, which really kind of pushed it well beyond the realm of closing in on a recount. And could be argued that even before, with the 219 votes, it was outside of that realm. So Ledesma Woody conceded, said she wasn't going to request a recount, and kind of closed that chapter of the primary. That was kind of the last little bit of drama that was lingering for the election night, March 1st.
It's funny, you know, the last time we talked, we speculated that U.S. Congressional District 35 might wind up in a runoff too. You know, we were thinking, you know, it might come down to Eddie Rodriguez conceding in order to avoid the runoff. Well, it didn't come anywhere near that, did it?
No, it didn't. Yeah, Kassar. I don't know if I'd call it an upset or a surprise victory, but yeah, he walked away with the nomination for the Democratic candidacy in that district with almost 70% of the vote. I haven't looked at the total this week, but yeah, he trounced the competition. Eddie was probably the most significant challenger, but he had two others he was running against. So it was a four-person race, and Kassar wound up with more than 60% of the votes. Yeah, he really earned that victory on election night. And given this is a heavily Democratic district, I think according to analysis by the Texas Tribune, it would have voted for President Biden by 60-70% as well in the 2020 election. So he's almost certainly going to be elected to Congress based on this win. He'll have a Republican challenger but it's just token opposition. They won't really stand any real chance of winning the general election in November.
Right. Well, as always, we appreciate your update on civic life in Austin. So thanks for joining us once again.
Yeah, thanks for having me on.
That's all from us this evening. Stay safe, everyone. And stay tuned for Co-op's Local Music Mix, next on the HD3 channel and on KOOP.org.